What did the founders think about the First Amendment, especially when it comes to the religion clauses? Hello, and welcome to this portion of Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and right now our guest is Dr. Peter Lilback.
Jerry, it's good to be with you.
Thank you. And Dr. Lilback and I wrote a book together called George Washington's Sacred Fire, which, by the grace of God and the promotion of Glenn Beck, ended up becoming a bestseller. But we're going to focus on the First Amendment. First of all, Dr. Lilback, when the country actually began, George Washington was sworn in as president in New York City. And it's my understanding that a lot of the founders and, you know, a lot of the states said, okay, we'll accept this Constitution, but we demand that there be certain rights enumerated, spelled out. And this led, of course, to the first 10 amendments, which we know as the Bill of Rights. And the very first liberty was what?
The very first liberty in the Bill of Rights is Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. In other words, government was stepping entirely out of the religion business in terms of its authority, but not getting in the way of anyone else to exercise, to be freely get engaged with their religious convictions. I think Philip Schaff, the great church historian, says, this is the first time in the history of humanity where the government renounced all authority in the sphere of religion for its country. That's quite remarkable. So it was really an utterly unique thing. And of course, when the Constitution is being developed, it was being framed here in Philadelphia in the very same room where the Declaration of Independence was being developed. This would be now 1787, mm-hmm. been Independence Declaration 1776. Mm-hmm. So 11 years later, the Articles of Confederation are not working. They meet there. And as they come together, they wrestle to find consensus. And when they do, there are some who are dissenters, people who say, we will not sign this Constitution. And so they had to ratify it by, I believe, 9 of the 13 colonies, yes, for it to become the new law of the land. And so part of the negotiating that went around in there to the dissenters and those who said, we cannot sign it, was, we will address your deep concern. And that concern was, it will be possible without protection of individual liberties, having a Bill of Rights, that the new government could actually use its power and take away our religious freedoms. And they said, we must have that. And so that was part of the promise that was negotiated under James Madison's leadership and others to help create a Bill of Rights, and that helped to assure, ultimately, the passage and implementation, ratification of the Constitution. So the Bill of Rights, while not part of the original Constitution, was present in its absence and its need, and it then became a reality. And, of course, then the first amendment that was adopted of the 12 that were proposed, mm-hmm. Only 10 were adopted, and the first one of the 10 that was adopted is the one that we call our Religious Freedom Clause, that gives us the right to exercise our religion and for Congress to make no law respecting the establishment of what we would agree on, and history would show, an established religious institution by the government, no official state church.
All right, excellent. Now, let me ask you this, just to clarify a few things. We know, of course, that Washington, D.C. became the capital of the country by a political compromise. They wanted to throw a bone to the South, if you will. And so that was created at the tail end of John Adams' presidency, but the process was in place even while George Washington was president, as I understand it. But initially, the Capitol was in New York City. Then it must have moved pretty quickly from 1789, moved pretty quickly to Philadelphia. And so right there at Independence Hall, you know, on the side of Independence Hall is a building which is the original Congress and Senate building. This is where they met when they were in Philadelphia. Can you explain that a little bit? Because it's my understanding it was in that building in Philadelphia that the Bill of Rights were adopted, or that they were voted on and accepted.
That is correct. So several things that we want to keep in mind. First of all, in the American Revolution, the state capital moved from city to city. And when the Philadelphia fell, The Congress actually eventually reconvened after fleeing into the wilderness in York and also Lancaster, Pennsylvania, far away in that day from the battles that were waging. And so,
Wait, can I stop you? Can I stop you right there?
Sure.
For one point in American history during the war, Lancaster, Pennsylvania was essentially the capital of the United States, essentially.
That is correct. That's
wow.
Where Congress met.
And, that's amazing. So I have cousins that live in that area.
It wasn't long, but it was there. And also York. And, of course, when Washington brings back his commission as the commanding officer, victorious general, he will meet the Continental Congress that's now meeting in Annapolis, Maryland.
Oh, wow.
And, of course, when he is inaugurated as the new president, it will be at Federal Hall in New York City. And after that, after the Congress gets organized, they will shortly thereafter take up residence in Philadelphia, where they will remain for the entirety of Washington's two terms. And then when Adams will take over, the capital of the United States will officially become what was then called the Federal City, and of course named in honor of George Washington. And so the White House, the House of the President, the first person ever to occupy that is then our second president, John Adams. But for the first two terms of Washington, Philadelphia becomes the capital of the United States. Now, there's all kinds of exciting things.
Can I stop you? Can I ask you, just real fast, we'll ask about the exciting things in a moment. Go back to New York City for a second. How long was the Washington administration working and the United States government centered in New York City as the U.S. capital?
I'm going to be embarrassed to say I cannot tell you precisely, but I think it was less than a year. They moved shortly.
Okay, so within months they moved to Philadelphia. Okay, excellent.
That's my understanding, and someone may check me and say I'm inaccurate, but it's a short period of time. It's not extensive.
Okay.
And so when you do come to Philadelphia now, when you think of where the Liberty Bell Visitor Center is, right?
Yes.
On Independence Mall in Philadelphia, you'll find some walls and doorsteps coming up right in front of it, and that was the home of a man named Robert Morris, often called the financier of the American Revolution, who gave up his home for Washington to live in, and that became, if you will, the first White House of the United States. Of course, history was not deemed all that significant then, and they tore it down, and they've only partially reconstructed it.
Right.
But you can actually go to the place where Washington lived, which is only essentially a block away on the other side of the mall, Independence Mall, from Independence Hall. So basically then what we call now Independence Hall is where it was the Pennsylvania State House. And interestingly, its beginning is the same date as George Washington's beginning. They both were begun in 1732. When Washington is born, that's when this building is being built. So fascinating parallel. No one even thought of it as Independence Hall until many years later, when the Marquis de Lafayette comes back on his great tour of America, and in the conversations with newspapers, he talks about the Great Hall of Independence, and then it is then shortened to the Independence Hall. So it's kind of later named many years after the Revolution and by Lafayette on his return visit, and so it has that name. But it was always the Pennsylvania State House. And so when you look at the building, the main building on the lower level on the left, that's where that ground floor room is where the Declaration and the Constitution were written. And then on the far right-hand side, when you look at on the right-hand wing, that on the upper level is where the Senate met. On the lower level is where the House of Representatives met. And it's under their work then that the Bill of Rights will be signed, and there's two signatures, interestingly, on the Bill of Rights. One of those copies, one of the last surviving copies, is actually in the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia, and there's two signatures, one for the Senate and one for the House of Representatives. The one for the Senate is John Adams. Remember, the Vice President to this day is kind of like the Speaker, if you will, of the Senate.
Yeah.
And then the Speaker of the House of Representatives, interestingly, is a man named Frederick Muhlenberg, who was an ordained Lutheran minister. And there's an extraordinary story, Jerry, I'd love for you to talk about on a future show about
sure.
the Muhlenberg family and their extraordinary contribution to the American independence. But what's significant is that a minister of the gospel basically signs into law the First Amendment that protects every minister of the gospel who preaches the gospel every Sunday and every day in between. So it's a wonderful concatenation of providence that allows that to happen. And of course, that happened right here in Philadelphia at the Independence Hall.
If Peter Muhlenberg or Frederick Muhlenberg or George Washington or whatever were to be able to come through a time machine and they would come to modern America and they would see the way we have this church and state relations, you know, where a little child can't write an essay about Jesus in school because of separation of church and state, while other religious ideas are allowed to flourish and even practice in some cases, what would they think of that? Would they think this is what we wanted to have happen?
Well, there's two famous Benjamins who are buried in the Christ Church burial ground right here in Philadelphia, right across from the U.S. Mint. One of them, of course, is Benjamin Franklin, and the other one is Benjamin Rush, both of them signers of the Declaration. And the reason I appeal to Benjamin Rush at this point is that he actually wrote a fascinating, about 8-page letter. It's available online if you look for it, where he will explain why he believes the Bible should be this textbook of American schools. Here's a signer and part of our beginning of our country.
Yes.
And one of his arguments is, why do we have to spend so much money on dealing with prisoners and rehabilitating them and having all the harm they do? How much better would be if we take those funds and purchase Bibles and make them part of our schools so people would learn to live with wisdom and with morality and integrity right from the beginning? And so he has a number of great arguments for why the Bible should be the school book of America. But now here are the people telling us all these years later, well, the First Amendment actually means we can't have the Bible as part of our country. So wait a second. Our founders, according to the University of Texas and their Political Science Review, was the most quoted by a book of all of our founders. One-third of all their citations, more than any other, comes right from the Bible. And so it was clear that that was part of the foundational knowledge that created America and our constitutional and our federal government system. So they would think it's appalling. George Washington, Jerry, as you know, was biblically literate from Genesis to Revelation and alluded, quoted and cited the Bible over 200 times that we show at least in our book.
Yeah. And in fact, you were just saying that the Bible was quoted more than any other source. But when you look at the human sources that were quoted, those people also quote the Bible. So, for example, John Locke is in that list. Well, John Locke, if you look at his discourses on civil government and so forth, you see lots of references to the Bible. Same thing with Sir William Blackstone. Well, we're almost out of time.
Well, you know,
yeah, but yeah, go
let
ahead.
Let me just add one thing. It's too important to pass up. John Locke, in writing in one of his letters, he will actually say the Bible is infallible. It's a book in which we find truth without error. What a high view of the Bible that is. And he is the leading political scientist that our founders looked to, other than Montesquieu, who also was a deeply religious person in his conviction. So it's quite remarkable.
Okay, we have about a minute left. What would you think would be a good way to kind of try and at least get back somewhat on track, you know, to the vision the founders had of religious flourishing and freedom for all?
I think the most important thing we could do is to rediscover what William Penn actually proposed when he spoke for the need for the protection of conscience. On his great book on the defense of religious liberty, he put on its cover Matthew chapter 7 and verse 12, "Do unto others as you'd have them do unto you." In other words, the golden rule of Jesus is the most brilliant statement ever penned for how we deal with one another, and when we apply it to the public square, it creates essentially the First Amendment's religious clauses. We don't want the government to put us in jail. We don't have a right to stop other people's consciences. What we got to do is treat each other with the same deference we want for ourselves. That's what creates religious liberty, and that is a great Christian virtue. It's called the Golden Rule, and I think that will take us a long way in the right direction.
All right, Dr. Peter Loback, providenceforum.org for more information. Thank you, Dr. Loback.
Thank you.